All right, so let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 19 and just continue the story. So we talked about Elijah. We were talking at our table last night about the fact that when you look at the heroes of the faith, when you look at them from a distance, they just look like larger-than-life people. They look like superhuman kind of guys that just had larger-than-life faith and didn't struggle with any of the stuff that we do. And I love the fact that James is so clear that Elijah was a man just like us. That Elijah's a person who struggled just like us, and hopefully over the last couple of sessions, you've seen a little bit of that. One of the things that I really love about Elijah is that in some ways, he's a man that is not even, he doesn't even have the same advantages that you and I sometimes have. We said that the very first session. He wasn't an extraordinarily gifted guy. His speeches weren't especially profound or long. He wasn't a guy of extraordinary means. Wasn't rich, didn't have a family legacy or history or pedigree, didn't have an extraordinary background. He was from the middle of nowhere. So in a lot of ways, the way that you and I tend to think about success and what it takes to be a successful man, we made that list last night of some of the things that it looks like to be a man that's full. In a lot of ways that our world looks at what success looks like and what it looks like to be a successful man, Elijah had none of that. And yet here we are looking at his life and living in his legacy thousands of years later. There's an old Baptist pastor, some of you maybe used to listen to on the radio, named Adrian Rogers. And he began a sermon one time by just having everybody in the congregation stay seated, and he started to list attributes one after another. So he just said, I want you to stand up, and we don't have to do this, but I want you to stand up if you were your high school's valedictorian. Across the auditorium, a few people stood up, and he said, okay, if you have ever been elected to lead people at something, stand up. If you've ever been a boss, stand up. If you've ever had people that reported to you, if you've ever been the captain of a sports team, would you stand up? If you have ever had letters beginning with C that followed your name, if you've ever been a CEO or a CFO or a COO, if you've ever owned your own business, if you have a college degree, would you stand up? And he just listed all of these attributes, and before long, just about everybody in the room was standing. And he looked at everybody in the room that was standing. He said, if this is you, if any of these things apply to you, I've got really great news for you. God can still use you. But you might not be his first choice. And it's true, when you look through the scriptures at all of the people that God chooses to use on a regular basis, it tends to be the underqualified. Tends to be the outcasts, the fishermen, the nobodies from nowhere who accomplish no things. God loves to use the empty because they're often in best position to be fully his. And all of us tend to, we search for fullness in a whole lot of different places. We search for fullness in our jobs. We search for fullness in our relationships. We search for fullness sometimes in substances or in hobbies. Especially when life gets hard, we run to those things and we can lose ourselves in those things and try to find hope in those things, and we just keep coming up empty in those things because hope's not found there. It's like trying to quench our thirst with ocean water. It looks promising, but it'll always leave us more thirsty than we started. And for some of us, perhaps that's our story. At least at some chapter of our life, we just went from relationship to relationship to relationship. And let's be honest, they're not getting any better. That was my college story. I was girl crazy in college and just chasing after relationship after relationship after relationship, trying to find the right one. And just a lot of things about that I wish I'd done a whole lot differently. But some of you, that's your story, relationship to relationship, marriage to marriage, job to job, hobby to hobby to hobby. And you're still coming up empty because you're looking for life in all the wrong places. Fullness isn't found in any of those. That's why all of the richest guys in the world keep chasing more riches. One of the richest guys in the world wants to be the president of the United States because there's just not enough found in any of those things, and it's just not worth it. And we're going to see the alternative as we wrap this up. So if you got your Bible open to 1 Kings chapter 19, we're going to start to end there and see Elijah live what he lived and to leave what he lived. And as we do that, I want to show you something about the guy that he leaves it to. So 1 Kings chapter 19 is where I want to start. Elijah's coming off his life as his emptiest. At the end of that passage, God tells him, you're not nearly as alone as you thought you were. And in fact, I'm about to work. I'm about to accomplish some stuff, and I'm about to accomplish some stuff through you, but after you. And you got to be okay with that definition of success. He's just sent Elijah to go find some of those people that God's going to work through and to commission them. One of those guys we read, his name is Elisha. That's where we pick up the story. So look at 1 Kings chapter 19, beginning in verse 19. So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, while he was plowing with 12 pairs of oxen before him, and he with the 12th. And Elijah passed over him and threw his mantle on him, and he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Please let me kiss my father and my mother, then I will follow you." And he said to him, "Go back again, for what have I done to you?" So he returned from following him and took the pair of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh with the implements of the oxen and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he arose and followed Elijah and ministered to him. Now, here's what you need to know about Elisha, because this thing doesn't necessarily translate to a 21st century kind of world. If I told you about a friend of mine, and some of you guys are ag guys, you get a little bit of this, but even still, if I told you I had a friend that was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen and driving the last pair, you would picture someone who needed to get a life, yeah? But somebody in Elisha's day would think, that's a guy who was filthy rich and uber talented. So most of the people in Elijah's day couldn't afford to own one ox. Elisha had 24, which implies that he had enough land that would need a pretty significant workforce to plow, and that he had the money to pay 11 other guys to drive yokes of oxen with him. And not only that, he's got the skill to drive one of the plows himself. So this is kind of the same effect as if I told you today that Elisha held 24 different companies and was the president and CEO of one of them just because he liked the challenge. Get that picture in your mind when you picture Elisha. And Elijah goes up to this Renaissance man and throws his cloak over him. The nasty, filthy garment that Elijah wore everywhere he went. Symbolically saying, you're going to get to do what I do. Which is quite an offer for a guy that owns 24 companies and runs one of them just for kicks. And then Elijah walks away. And we know he walks away because it says that Elisha drops everything and goes running after him. Right off the bat, you know that Elisha knows what he's in for. He knows he's not coming back from this. And we know because he tells Elijah, "Let me say goodbye to my parents." And Elijah says, "Whatever you need, dude. Like, this was not my idea. My idea was fire from heaven. You're God's idea, so take it up with him. Do whatever you want. What's it to me?" So Elisha goes back, and you see what he does? He slaughters his animals. He burns his plows. And everyone around has to have what has to have been a pretty incredible feast. You see what he's doing here? Throws this feast for all of the people. He's going public with his faith. He's telling all of the people around him that he knows what he's doing, that he knows that he knows what he knows, that fullness isn't found in the stuff that I've had. It's not found in the talent I possess. It's not in the relationships around me. And in a really public way, he's saying to all of those people who have known him for a really long time, I'm not going back from here. And it's not like he's doing it begrudgingly. It's not like it's having to be wrenched from his hands. He throws a party to celebrate what God's called him to do. And don't miss the point. The point isn't if you have wealth or talent or relationships that you're going to have to throw them all away to have a heart that's fully God's. Yeah, there are examples of that in the scriptures and all throughout church history. There are also examples of people who had the opposite of that, who had wealth, extraordinary wealth, or talent, or relationship that God continued to use in extraordinary ways. The point isn't that Elisha gave all of those things up. The point's that he saw their real value. In this case, when he could trade something of lesser value in order to pursue something of greater value, he sees it as a no-brainer. We see Elisha's heart here. It's a heart that believed beyond anything else, nothing fulfills like a heart he fills. Nothing fulfills like a heart he fills. Elisha gets the offer to carry the mantle of Elijah. He could serve as the mouthpiece of the God of the universe, be used by God in an extraordinary way. God would continue to give him enough and use him for incredible things. But in Elisha's case, it would probably mean giving up comfort and giving up power and going into hiding, becoming weak, giving up safety, giving up wealth. And Elisha goes running after the opportunity. In effect, saying, nothing could be more fulfilling than this. Not my comfort, not my power, not my riches, not my family. Nothing could be more fulfilling than running hard after whatever God calls me to. And some of us need that kind of courage, don't we? Like in a dating relationship with somebody that you know is in direct conflict with your call to follow God. Some of us have hobbies, you know, that are in direct conflict with our ability to follow God. It might not be sinful. It may not be wrong. It may not be wrong for anybody else. Nothing wrong with driving oxen. You may have friends that do the exact same things and don't need to walk away. But even as we're talking about it, you know, it's time for you to slaughter some oxen and walk towards a greater purpose, whatever that looks like in your life. Not to make God happy. Not to earn God's favor. You know this. This is a grace place. There's an opportunity, though, you know, to reflect that you've already found it, that it's fully and completely yours as a gift that cost you nothing from Jesus. And you have a chance to reflect that for the world. You don't need all of that stuff to reflect it. Maybe what you'll realize is what Elisha knew all along. Fullness wasn't ever found there to begin with. He found fullness in the God that he served and nowhere else, to the point that when God invites him to do something, he doesn't see all of the other stuff as stuff to be held on to. He saw it as stuff to be leveraged to go public with what God had already given him, have an opportunity for as many people as possible to be a part of the party for what God's doing in his life. What a cool way to think about your job. Now think about your relationships. Think about your bank account. Not as stuff to be held onto with a white-knuckle grip, but as stuff to be leveraged to show and to tell who God is and what he's like to every person you're sent towards. Like, I don't think it's an accident that you're placed where you're placed. I don't think it's an accident that you live where you live, not just in the town where you live, but in the house that you live, on the street where you live. You thought you bought it because it was the right configuration, the right amount of land, you know, the right number of bedrooms and the right proximity to the right school or close enough to your work and all of this. You thought it was about you. You thought it was about convenience. But have you ever backed it up and wondered why that particular lot, why that particular house, why that particular apartment was available for you at the time that you were looking for? Is it possible that God had a plan for the place that he placed you and he has a purpose for you and living there? For that house, for that place, for your bank account, for your job, your office, your desk, where your desk sits, your cube, where your cube is, your dorm room, where your dorm room sits, with your particular roommates at this particular point in time might have a purpose that God's ordained before the foundation of the earth and is inviting you to live towards. And all of it, the place that you live, the stuff that you have, the relationships you've been given, are things that can be leveraged for you as you, who you are, where you are, to show and to tell who God is and what he's like wherever you're sent. That's what Elisha's showing. Losing all of his stuff didn't make Elisha empty. It showed everybody else that he was full. So he walked away and he becomes Elijah's servant and he serves Elijah for several years before the tangible payoff. Before we see exactly what God had prepared, and I want to show you that, flip over to a couple of pages to 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 2. Elisha's been following Elijah for several years. God's revealed to Elijah and Elisha and all of these prophets that it's time for Elijah to go to heaven. Elijah's lived a full life, even though his full life was spent, for the most part, we've seen it, living on empty. He lived through a famine by trusting God to bring him bread and meat every day by birds, living by a stream and drinking water from a brook that would dry up. Then God gave him enough to get to a widow's house all the way across the wilderness where he was being pursued by an enemy. He had to trust God for enough food. He had enough to make it through a showdown with the prophets of Baal and the threats of a king, and enough to live through a life of almost constant fear on the run for his life against an evil king. In fact, nothing has turned out the way that Elijah thought that would. God didn't give Elijah enough on the front end to make it to this day. gave him enough every day to make it for the next step. And Elijah strung together several different faithful steps where he makes it to this day at the end of his story. Well, at least this chapter of his story. I want to see you how a full life overflows. Look at 2 Kings chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. It says, "And it came about when the Lord was about to take up Elijah by a whirlwind to heaven, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. And Elijah said to Elisha, 'Stay here, please, for the Lord sent me as far as Bethel.' But Elisha said, 'As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you.'" Isn't that interesting? Elijah spends most of his life alone. At the end of his life, God gives him a friend who won't leave him alone. It says they went down to Bethel. Then the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel, so think seminary, think prophets in training, came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" And he said, "Yeah, I know. Be still." He's saying, "Fellas, I don't want to talk about it." Verse 4, "And Elijah said to him, 'Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord sent me to Jericho.' But he said, 'As the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will not leave you.' So they came to Jericho. And the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho approached Elisha and said to him, 'Do you know the Lord will take away your master from over you today?' And he answered, 'Yes, I know. Be still. I still don't want to talk about it.' Then Elijah said to him, 'Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan.' And he said, 'As the Lord lives, as you yourself live, I will not leave you.' So the two of them went on. Now 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood opposite them at a distance, while the two of them stood by the Jordan. And Elijah took his mantle and folded it together and struck the waters, and they were divided here and there, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground." So that's power, right? I mean, it sends a serious signal to everybody who's looking that the God who filled Elijah is the same God who was with Moses in the flash and the bang on the mountain when he led the people over a body of water. He's the same God that was with Joshua when Joshua led the people across the Jordan River. Same God. Verse 9, "When they'd crossed over, Elijah said to Elisha, 'Ask what I shall do for you before I'm taken from you.' And Elisha said, 'Please, let a double portion of your spirit be upon me.'" Which is positively insane, isn't it? Elisha's asking for the blessing of the firstborn son who would get an extra part of the inheritance. You know why he would get an extra part of the inheritance? Because he had an extra part of the responsibility. It was his responsibility. It fell on his shoulders to care for the family and the family business when his dad died. And Elisha's saying, "Elijah, I want to shoulder the responsibility that you've had. I want to carry the mantle that you've been carrying. Being used by God as the family inheritance, I want to shoulder the responsibility you've had." And Elijah says, verse 10, "You ask a hard thing." He says, "You know what this means, Elisha? Like, if you're thinking about flash and bang and silos of provision in your backyard and a big buffet for you to feed just whenever you want, if you're thinking about the life of comfort that you left, if you're thinking about the things that come with the 24 businesses you've been CEO of and you're in charge of one of them and you just command and things happen for you and you think about the salary that's coming into you and all of the comfort that you've had and the security you felt, if you're thinking about that, I need you to think about what this looks like for me. Like, think about the life that I've been called to. It means you're probably going to run on empty. Trusting God to provide just enough for every day of your life. Like, for me," Elijah says, it's meant days when I didn't know if I'd live. Days when I didn't know what I'd live on, where I was conscious every single day that the only thing that could bring me fullness is the God I served." And Elisha doesn't have to say anything because he's already said it when he burned the oxen. He knows what he's signing up for. Elijah says, "You're not asking for the easy road, and it's not my role to give." But he tells Elisha enough for the next step. Keep looking. "So nevertheless, if you see me when I'm taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so." Keep your eyes open for what God's doing. Just watch around you. See what he does. Then it came about as they were going along and talking that, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, which separated the two of them. And Elisha went up by a whirlwind to heaven. Isn't it just like God to give Elijah what he'd wanted all along? Remember back when Elijah was in his emptiest, depressed in a cave? It was because he was so caught up in the fire from heaven that he wanted everybody to see it to get it. And now you notice what takes him to heaven? It's a symbol of heaven's battle, a chariot with horses of fire. What grace God shows him. And do you realize when it shows up for Elisha? It shows up as they're walking, as they're going. Normal day, normal place, normal things, and God of heaven shows up in a big way. One of these days, read through the book of Acts and watch how many times the most miraculous things happen. Watch how many times the most extraordinary things happen in the book of Acts, and Luke tells us as they were going. As they were on their way from where they were to where they thought they would be, Jesus shows up, the Spirit shows up and does extraordinary things through them. As they're being witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth, watch how often it happens, not just in the spiritual place, not just in the place they expected, but in the place as they're going to the place they expected. And here, as they're going, as they're walking and talking together, symbol of heaven's battle shows up and a chariot with horses of fire show up. In verse 12, Elijah saw it and cried out, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And he saw Elijah no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and he tore them into two pieces. He also took up the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and returned and stood by the bank of the Jordan, took the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and struck the waters and said, where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? And when he'd also struck the waters, they were divided here and there, and Elisha crossed over. The legacy continues. God picks up with Elisha exactly where he left off with Elijah, and everyone who followed them knew that the God who was with Moses, the God who was with Joshua, the God who was with Elijah, was the God who was with Elisha. Elijah lived his whole life running on empty. But at the end of his life, after God provided enough time after time after time, there was still enough to spill over into somebody else. This is the exclamation point on Elijah's life. Filled lives leave full legacies. Filled lives leave full legacies. And isn't that the greatest gift that God could give a leader? Isn't that the greatest gift that God could give a dad, a husband, a grandfather? To work through someone whose heart is fully his to the point that while they're here, he gives them responsibility for something so important to him that it will not die with them. So let me ask you this, we prepare to close the weekend. Who's coming after you? It may not be as dramatic as Elijah's handoff to Elisha. But who are the people in your life that you would look at? Who would look at your life and say, I want to be like that guy. It's worth whatever I've got. Because he found fullness in all the right places. And I'm going to stick with him like glue until I can have what he's had. Whatever it is. And what is it? For you. The challenge from Elijah's life at the end of the day is to live for the long run. Not just the next year long run. Not even the 10-year long run. Not even the 100-year long run. Live for the 10 billion year long run. However that looks from today. just enough for the next step. Two stories and we'll end. You're probably familiar with J.R.R. Tolkien, writer of the Lord of the Rings books. What you may not know that as he was trying to write those books, he quit several times. He just could never get it right. Figured it would never amount to anything. In the middle of one of those seasons where he was ready to quit, he wrote a short story about an artist named Niggle, who was commissioned to create a work for a town. He decided he'd paint a beautiful tree on the back of City Hall. He worked for years on this masterpiece, under a huge covering to hide the work so that nobody else could see it. One day, somebody came along and pulled off the covering after years of Niggle's work and found out that Niggle, at that point, had only painted one leaf. They called him over and they said, "Niggle, where's the rest of it?" And just despondent, he said, I'm trying. And he was trying, he just couldn't get it done. He had this goal. He had this vision. He had this dream. But as hard as he tried, he just couldn't quite grab a hold of it. So every day he showed up just trying to do a little more. As the story goes, Niggle dies. And he's on a train traveling through heaven when suddenly he sees something off to the side and demands that they stop the train. And this is the way that Tolkien wrote it. It said, "Before him stood the tree, his tree, finished." If you could say that of a tree that was alive, its leaves opening and its branches growing and bending in the wind that Niggle had so often felt or guessed, but so often failed to catch. He gazed at the tree and slowly lifted his arms and opened them wide and said, "What a gift." Whatever the Lord has given you to do, however far away it feels today, however empty you feel in this moment, do it with all your might. Trust him with every single step, with every single outcome. Who knows what the Lord will do through that life, with that legacy, even if you can't quite grab it and nobody else understands it. Last story. You familiar with the story of William Borden? He was an heir to the Borden family fortune, graduated from high school in 1904, when the Borden Milk family was one of the most profitable businesses in the United States. Made this young high school graduate one of the richest men in the country. When he graduated from high school, his parents gave him an all-expense-paid luxurious trip all around the world. But as he traveled, something happened to him. He became overwhelmed with all of the people in the world who hadn't heard the story of Jesus, who didn't know who he was or what he was like. They didn't know anything about the resurrection. They didn't know anything about the hope that was available to them by a gift of free grace. And he couldn't shake the sense that God wanted him to be some part of God's plan to take life to him. So he burned the oxen. He came home one day and told his dad he didn't want to take on the family business after all. He wanted to become a missionary. His parents were furious. Some of his friends even told him, "You're a moron. Like, you were throwing everything away. You're going to waste your life." But Borden's mind was made up. He was going to leverage everything he had for the thing that mattered most to him. So he graduated from Yale and then Princeton Seminary. And then he climbed on a boat and headed for China. Because he wanted to work with the Muslims in China, he stopped in Egypt to spend some time learning Arabic. That's where the story turns. 1 month after arriving in Egypt, he contracted spinal meningitis and died. 25 years old. Back in the United States, the headlines proclaimed the tragic news. The stories echoed the advice that Borden's friends and family had given him. What a waste of a life. But Borden didn't think so. As the story goes, on his deathbed, somebody asked him if he had any final words. He could barely speak, so he pulled out a Bible. He turned to a blank page in the Bible, and he wrote two words: "No regrets." from the perspective of the world, Borden's life was a total waste. From the perspective of 10 billion years, it wasn't. His wasn't a wasted life. You see that. It was a worthy one. William Borden's buried in a small cemetery in Cairo. Cemetery so out of the way, if you don't know what you're looking for, you'll never find it. His tombstone's bunched up against many other tombstones, and the writing on it's so faint you can barely read it, but if you get down real close, you can make out a single sentence. Apart from faith in Christ, there is no explanation for such a life. That's a legacy. Apart from faith in Christ, no explanation for such a life. I want to live that kind of story. I want to leave that kind of legacy. What about you? What's at the center of your life? If the thing you're living for, is it worth giving your life to? Or is something else at the center? Something else filling you up? Take it from Borden. Take it from Elijah. Take it from Elisha. Take it from me. Take it from D.L. Moody, one of my favorite quotes of all time. He said, "The world has yet to see what God can do with a man fully consecrated to him. By God's grace, I aim to be that man." Me too. Live life to the fullest, guys. Looking to Christ alone for your fullness. And let the life that you're living be a legacy worth leaving, wherever he leads you from here. The world has yet to see what God can do with a man fully consecrated to him. By his grace, let's be those guys.